And thanks to Eyal, Harold, and Tomohiro-san for the invitation to speak, indeed, twice today. My task is to address the international law aspects of withdrawal and disengagement from multilateral agreements and institutions. International law gives almost total freedom to states to decide whether to accept a treaty or to join an international organization. But once they have consented, international law narrows the circumstances in which they may lawfully withdraw, terminate. But at the same time, what Harold also spoke about was this kind of in-between grey zone of disengagement or the lame duck stage. And in that period, again, we have quite a broad spectrum of allowed behaviour. Recent developments in the US and the UK have taught us how difficult it is to disengage from international regimes into which we are already deeply nested, even if those treaties contain a withdrawal clause. And this has led to some creative lawyering and perhaps some rash decision-making. I'm going to speak first about the Vienna Convention provisions on withdrawal and disengagement, including this notion of unsigning a treaty that Harold mentioned with respect to the Arms Trade Treaty, and which the US also did with respect to the ICC statute. I'm then going to focus on the notion of changed circumstances, which has come up in the Brexit debate and may also be used by other states such as the US as a justification for termination. And finally, I'm going to consider how you might reform an organisation or treaty body under international law without crippling it. So first, turning to the Vienna Convention. Under international law, a state may withdraw from any binding international agreement according to the provisions of that agreement, if the treaty does indeed include a provision, or with the consent of all the parties. Now, most treaties do contain these withdrawal clauses, for instance, Article 28 of the Paris Agreement, which we're going to discuss this morning. But even if a treaty doesn't contain an express clause, the Vienna Convention in Article 56 says that international law permits withdrawal if the parties intended to allow a right of withdrawal or there is an implied right, usually implied from the nature of the treaty. And the withdrawing party in that case would give 12 months' notice of its intent to depart. Now, once a decision has been taken to depart, the Vienna Convention provides that this may be expressed through any act declaring invalid, terminating, withdrawing from, or suspending the operation of a treaty pursuant to its provisions through an instrument communicated to the other parties, and that has to be done by someone with full powers or who is assumed to have full powers. Unlike the provisions on joining a treaty, this procedural requirement of withdrawal does not contain any express reference to domestic law, and this can indeed lead to tensions with domestic law requirements that I think Edward is going to expand on. But what if the state is a signatory and not yet a party to a treaty? Article 18 of the Vienna Convention provides that such a state is obliged to refrain from acts which would defeat the object and purpose of the treaty. And this is until it has made its intention clear not to become a party to the treaty or indeed decided to take on the full obligations under the treaty. As Harold has written, when President George W. Bush claimed to unsign the ICC statute, it demonstrated the futility of announcing a withdrawal under terms not prescribed by an international agreement. And indeed, it led to an unchanged nature of the US status vis-a-vis the ICC under international law. So when the Obama administration came in, it was able to simply ignore the letter of unsigning, which was indeed sent by John Bolton, and was able to re-engage with the Assembly of States parties during the next 8 years and in a very active manner. Now, quite apart from these provisions on withdrawal and termination, certain superseding events, such as material breach by another party, or a fundamental change in circumstances, or a supervening impossibility of performance, may give rise to a right to terminate. Now, in theory, these bases for termination seem less opportunistic than withdrawal under provisions of the treaty, or even unsigning, because they reflect changed circumstances beyond the party's control, or at least the terminating party's control. But I think we've seen recently that they are open to manipulation. One issue that has led to a lot of writing on Article 62 is how the UK might terminate the Northern Ireland backstop. The Attorney General suggested in his advice in March that there is a respectable argument that if the EU's agreement to terminate the backstop were not forthcoming, and if the facts clearly warranted it, the UK could unilaterally terminate the withdrawal agreement on the grounds of unforeseen and fundamental change of circumstances, invoking Article 62 of the Vienna Convention. I would align myself with the view of the legal opinion published by the People's Vote campaign, authored by David Anderson QC, Sam Wordsworth QC, and others, which doubts the possibility of using Article 62 in these circumstances. Article 62 contains five cumulative conditions. The change must be to the circumstances existing at the time of the conclusion of the treaty. It must be a change not foreseen by the parties. The change must be fundamental. And the existence of the circumstances which have changed must have constituted an essential basis for the consent of the parties. And finally, the effect of that change must be radically to transform the scope of the obligations still to be performed under the treaty. It is indeed a wholly exceptional ground for terminating treaties. It has been argued several times before the International Court of Justice. The court has never accepted it, most prominently in the Gavchikovo-Nazimyros judgment. The court found that the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the disintegration of the Warsaw Pact, and the fact that the other party to the treaty, Czechoslovakia, no longer existed, was not enough to change radically the nature of the treaty obligation to build a dam on the Danube River. There's been one case that gave some weight to Article 62, which was the Racker case before the European Court of Justice, but it adopted a very deferential standard of review, basically saying that there was no manifest error of assessment to rely on Article 62, rather than actually saying Article 62 was found in that case. Now, we all know the arguments on Brexit. I won't spend much time on them. But the possibility of the backstop becoming permanent if the negotiations are unsuccessful is not only clear on the face of the withdrawal agreement itself, but it's been emphasised in the advice of the Attorney General. So if we look at the second condition to Article 62, it's not only foreseeable, but it's been foreseen and expressly provided for. And if we think about the fifth condition of radical transformation, such a change would not radically transform the scope of the obligations to be performed under the treaty. In fact, all that would have happened is that a possibility expressly provided for in Article 1.4 of the treaty would have come to pass. And we mustn't forget, as we talk about the possibilities of invoking Article 62, that its effect, if successful, would be to terminate the entire withdrawal agreement, not just the backstop provision. So now turning to encouraging change to a treaty body without crippling it. States withdraw or threaten to withdraw, not always because they want to get out of their obligations or out of future cooperation, but also as a strategy to raise their voices and push for reform. And Harold mentioned in his introduction the US and UNESCO. Since the 1970s and 1980s, the US has used exits and threats of exit, which of course come with the loss of funding, critically for UN organisations, to pressure UNESCO to change its behaviour. The US helped found UNESCO after the Second World War. President Reagan withdrew in 1984, accusing it of being biased towards the Soviet Union. The US rejoined in 2002, and on the 1st of January, it withdrew again, this time accusing UNESCO of anti-Israel bias because of the admission of Palestine as a full member to the organisation. Now, there are ways short of such exit or threats of exit to disengage from international institutions. There may be a refusal to participate in decision-making. We've seen some of this with the WTO, which Michael will talk about. There can be a refusal to abide by rules, and dispute settlement decisions. There may be a refusal to appear. Most recently, Guyana has brought a case against Venezuela at the ICJ. Venezuela was due to file its counter-memorial a couple of weeks ago and instead sent a letter saying that it will not be appearing in the case. So we have this form of disengagement as well. Now, Lawrence Helfer, who's written on treaty exit, said that a state that absents itself from international organisations may effectively discredit those entities in the eyes of other states or its domestic interest groups, but it could also possibly have a law-promoting function. Given the international legal system's relatively anarchic environment in which surreptitious shirking of treaty obligations is plausible, a state's decision to follow the rules of the game, to publicise a future withdrawal, and to open itself to scrutiny may demonstrate a kind of respect for international law. I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I don't think that's what we're seeing with the current attitude of the Trump administration to some of these organisations. And I'd just like to contrast the US attitude towards the ICC with that of other leaders. So the ICC has attracted significant criticism over its short lifespan, and most recently that has intensified with the rejection of an investigation of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Afghanistan, not because of the rejection per se, but because of the reasoning of the pretrial chamber, which cites a lack of confidence that the court could actually do the job as the reason for the rejection. And this has led four former presidents of the ICC Assembly of States parties on Friday to call for an independent assessment of the court's functioning by a small group of international experts. This is an example of criticism, urge for reform, but constructive engagement. In contrast, we see with the Trump administration and John Bolton, the announcement of unprecedented measures against court officials, including denial of the visa to the prosecutor, simply blocking them from carrying out their work with full judicial independence. So I'll conclude with three observations. We have to remember, as we talk about this topic, that we shouldn't conflate withdrawal with the breach of a treaty. A breach may affect a single article, a handful of articles, it might be material or non-material. And a breach does not necessarily result in the termination of a state's membership. Even if it's a material breach, it entitles but does not require the other parties to suspend or terminate. Unilateral withdrawal also may have more significant impacts on cooperation and the functioning of an organisation than a breach, depending on the circumstances. Second, formal legal rules, such as those in the Vienna Convention, provide only a partial explanation of why governments continue to adhere to their treaty commitments, even when a lawful and largely unfettered exit option is available. States both cooperate and refuse to cooperate for a multitude of reasons, institutional, political, reputational, and it's not just the Vienna Convention that will explain that behaviour. And third, and relatedly, when we look at what is driving state behaviour, we should acknowledge that they're not always behaving rationally. And we need to factor this in to our responses if we want to encourage changes in their behaviour. The Brexit negotiations have not only been a puzzle for legal scholars, they've also been a puzzle for psychologists and scholars of international bargaining. Benjamin Martel and Uta Steiger have studied this from a psychological perspective, and they say the following. Received wisdom has it that hard bargaining strategies make sense only when accompanied by significant advantage in bargaining power, meaning material capabilities, viable alternatives, and credible domestic constraints. When such conditions do not exist, hard bargaining creates reputational costs, diminishes credibility, and decreases the chance of a deal. And yet, the United Kingdom has pursued a hard bargaining strategy from a position of relative weakness. If we want to have a positive future of multilateralism in the US and in the UK, that's going to depend on not just on the law, but on replacing a psychology of intransigence that we see in some cultures with one of more flexibility and accommodation.